And Captain Josh Kyle, Riley County Police Department, 537-1350. If you have questions or comments, this will be our last segment with him. And I know that we briefly mentioned mental health, and at one time you were very involved. I know a couple of years back during I went to one of the task force meetings, you were the one that had all the numbers and actual examples of the calls, which always has stuck with me, the variety of the types of calls you get on a daily basis. We've come a long way in a couple of years. I mean, I know we can go farther, and the legislative forum that was held Tuesday I thought was very good sharing of some thoughts. But just from your perspective, and I think you've been involved up until about 4 months ago, you changed roles at RCPD. But.
Yeah, what a serious issue. And again, it's another one of those things where you see a number of issues coming together and then intersecting in the area of law enforcement. And mental health is definitely one of those areas. And you're right, we've seen significant change. I was involved in that group just by the very nature of my position. And then I saw over a three-year period going from us getting together and talking about mental health issues to us getting together and doing things about mental health issues. And one of those areas was the co-responder program that started when I was in patrol, not because of me, but it happened while I was there. So I had a lot of responsibility with trying to get the program off the ground. We went to Johnson County. Johnson County had a program. It still does for a number of years. And we talked to them and found out, okay, from your perspective, what is it we need to know about the co-responder program? We learned quite a bit. Pawnee Mental Health courses. It's a partnership between the two of us. The co-responders are actually employees of Pawnee Mental Health, but they work under full-time contract for RCPD, and so their day-to-day duties are under the responsibility of RCPD. And it's been a wildly successful program. One of the first things that we had to do was come up with some, I'm a numbers person, you know, we talk about evidence, and if you talk about evidence, you got to have numbers. And the thing about co-responders programs is that they're so new, there's not been a lot of research on it. It's one of those areas where we're going to have to wait another couple of years to 5 years to get a lot of research to figure out what's effective and not effective. But in the meantime, it's up to us to come up with our own measurements. And so in that conversation that we had with the folks in Johnson County, we came up with a number of things that we were looking at. And the early numbers were really interesting. 75% of the people we make contact with are not currently enrolled in mental health services. That's huge. That's very significant because that's usually why they're in crisis and why we're talking to them is because they're not enrolled at all in mental health services. They have no contact whatsoever. And so what a great gateway to get people who are in crisis immediately in services. Another significant thing that came up as a result of the co-responder program was this definition of what mental health crisis is. To us, that always meant that the person who was wanting to hurt themselves or the person who was unable to cope with daily life and it was creating some kind of emergency, they were unable to care for themselves in some way. But we found out very quickly, it's not just that. What about the person that has an ongoing alcohol or drug problem? They have a mental health issue and they're in crisis. And we're like, well, that's a whole nother. No, it's not. To the people at Pawnee Mental Health, that's a mental health issue that's going into crisis and needs to be addressed right away. And we were really surprised to see the co-responders dive into those issues and start following up. And that's the other thing that's really important. It's not just that the co-responders are going to the call and handling the call with the officers, but they're also conducting a lot of follow-up. People who are not enrolled in mental health services need that follow-up. The phone call or the visit afterwards to say, okay, how are you doing? Did you make your appointment? How's it going with you right now? Do you have food in the house? You know, are you what kind of thoughts are you having? So it really creates this proactive way for law enforcement, which is usually one of the, again, visible and accessible, usually one of the quickest people that find out, as soon as people find out that something's going on, or the police, we usually ones that get the phone call, and allows us to then create that bridge between those initial calls, that crisis moment, and mental health services beyond just taking people up to the hospital, which then goes into a whole nother area because it's been amazing to watch the co-responders. Situations that we've seen that we thought, okay, well, we got to take this person up to the hospital. No, they're okay. We've got a safety plan. I have a master's degree in this. I practice all day as a practitioner. I know that this person, or it's my professional opinion, this person's going to be fine over the weekend. We've got an appointment with them on Monday. We'll do follow-up with them. They'll be fine. They don't need to go up to the hospital right now. we've also had the other side where they said, this person needs to go up to the hospital now. And we're like, well, we're not seeing any of the typical. No, we're familiar with the situation and the person and the type of mental health issue they're dealing with, and they need to go to the hospital right now. And that's been an interesting process to watch, which then leads into a whole other area, which is the issue of culture change. And when I got involved with the police training officer program I talked about earlier, that involved culture change. If you start training officers to be problem solvers and train officers to community outreach, that requires a cultural shift within the organization to make happen. Same thing I think is true, and something I don't think I was really prepared for. I wasn't prepared for the amount of time that officers were going to be involved in these calls and the amount of time that was going to be required for follow-up, because Kansas City told us you want to have officers there for a lot of these home visits. They need to be there. It's a safety issue sometimes, and so you want to have the officers there. I wasn't prepared for that. I didn't really think about that as much as it became apparent as we got involved, the amount of time that officers need to be involved, and the culture shift that was going to occur, because officers now need to think of themselves as, no, this is not, you're not going to handle the call the way you always did in the past. The co-responder is there with you and heavily involved in the call as you go on. Don't call them as an afterthought. That's not what they're there for. They're there to be there at the very beginning, helping you make decisions and get information that you need to do the right thing for the right reasons.
Well, again, only a few more minutes left here with Captain Kyle, 537-1350. Moving along, and I know that under your area of expertise now and your roles and responsibilities, Operation ARC, and we've talked about that, I believe, before, but we might briefly remind our listeners what that is and maybe just a quick update.
Okay, so the short version is, how can a police department create an environment of traffic safety while enforcing the law and keeping everybody happy?
Good luck.
Yeah, I know. And so we were aware of this thing called procedural justice. Procedural justice says the process by which you make decisions is as important, if not more important, than the decision you make. So, for example, are you fair in your decision making? Are your motives trustworthy? Do you give people a voice? And do you treat them with dignity and respect? And if you do those four things consistently, then people are much more likely to accept the decisions that you make. So one of the first things that we needed to do, of course, is partner with Kansas State University, especially Dr. Sue Williams. We had done so in the past on a number of other projects, and we did it again with this one. And the idea here was, how can we take these four concepts of procedural justice and infuse them into a traffic accident reduction strategy? And so the first thing we did is Dr. Sue Williams put together a series of focus groups, and it was Manhattan citizens, and then asked them, What do you think the police department should focus on when it comes to traffic enforcement? And they overwhelmingly said traffic safety. And they came up with a list of five things that they thought was important. DUI enforcement was at the top, speeding, failure to stop, tailgating, those kinds of things they thought that we should focus on. And then we took a look at and then they did some surveys as well, people who had actually been stopped by RCPD officers. They couldn't get them in the room for a focus group, so they created a survey and surveyed them over the phone, had a really good return rate. So then in the next step, what we did is we took a look at our accident data, and we found out, same thing, that there was these top five reasons that cause accidents, everything from inattentive driving, cell phone use was one of the things that people mentioned in the focus groups, to tailgating, to speed, to failure to yield right away, those kinds of things. And so they matched up. The priority levels were a little bit different, but they matched up really well as far as causation was concerned. And so then what we did was we had officers build a script. They did it themselves. We gave them a voice as well, where they built a script, and using those four elements of procedural justice that we used in the program itself, and then that's part of what they talk about. So, for example, an officer makes a car stop and says, "Hi, that's the reason I stopped you today was for speeding. Speeding is a leading cause of accidents. K-State's conducted a survey. They found that that's one of the top reasons, things that people want us to enforce. That's why we're here talking today." So that little script changes.
Real quickly, okay. We have a phone call, and okay. We only have a minute left.
Okay, here we go.
Go ahead, real quick.
The quick question is, when you got the cell phone hands-free driving, it was a big deal. How come they're not enforcing it anymore? If you just sit on the street and watch, about every fifth car, somebody's talking on the phone. I don't understand why we're not enforcing it. If it was so important then, why isn't it now? Behind them.
30 seconds.
That's a great, great question, and here's your answer. Number one is because voluntary compliance is what leads to accident reduction, not just enforcement. Number two is we're in a technology bubble where it's difficult for us to have a situation where phones basically shut up or shut off or work with your cars. That's changing. And the third reason is, well, we get pressure too, like everybody else. If we go out and we stop every car that's moving that somebody's using a cell phone, we take a lot of heat for that. And that was actually one of the major reasons behind Operation ARC, was to ask the public, like you, what do you think? And they actually came back and said cell phone is one of them. And we're going to get the final results of the final study by the end of the year. And then I think we're going to move forward using that information. So you may see more cell phone enforcement. But again, the focus is on accident reduction, getting people to change behaviors, not just write a lot of tickets.
Time flies, boy. We had lots of good information today. Captain Josh Kyle with us today, Riley County Police Department.